you know, we think of imagination as something that takes us away from the world, but this, whatever this form of imagination that I'm in and developing and being influenced by and developing a practice around, is imagination that brings us more closely into relationship with the world. And I call the practices that I've developed moral imagination, which maybe is different to fantastical imagination or creative imagination, or, you know, so there's something to me that is a moral act to develop a deeper connection with the world as it is, rather than try and escape it.
Welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast, where we talk to inspiring guests about the human dimension of sustainability and explore the link between our personal journeys and the positive impact we can have on the world. My name is Tamsin Walker. This month's episode is all about imagination and how we can awaken it from its dormancy. To lead us through this exciting and endless topic, I'll be talking to Phoebe Tickell. She's a British-Hungarian biologist, systems thinker, and imagination activist, who's worked with local governments and communities and the education and agricultural sectors to unlock the kind of thinking that allows people to conceive of different ways of shaping the world. She's also the founder of Moral Imaginations, an organization driving a movement to inject sentient life back into the heart of established systems and to create futures rooted in values, a connection to others, the natural world, and a moral sense of what's important. Welcome, Phoebe.
Thank you so much for having me, Tamsin. Excited for the chat.
Well, we are obviously going to be talking about imagination today and the role of imagination in sort of creating a less crisis-ridden world. But before we get into that, I wanted to invite you to take us on a little bit of a journey to a place. Is there somewhere that was particularly important for you as a child?
Well, the place that comes to mind for me is a forest outside of a place called Győr in Hungary. It's in Western Hungary near the border with Austria. And I'm half Hungarian, and I kind of split my childhood between London and this quite rural part of Hungary. We'd spend long summer holidays there with my sister and, you know, with my family, but my sister and I would just go off and play for hours, sometimes on the banks of the Danube. But yeah, this forest has a very special place in my memory. And we would do campfires and camping and kind of traditional Hungarian cooking over the fire. So it's got a special place in my memory.
Do you feel that that also set you off in terms of having a connection with the natural world?
I guess so. It's funny. It's not when you grow up connected to nature, I don't think you think about it like a special thing. You're just kind of like, this is just life. I just felt connected. Yeah, I think I did have a childhood growing up feeling quite connected to the world. And it also drove a lot of curiosity about the natural world. And I went on to study biology partly because of that. I think I did grow up with definitely more connection to the natural world than if I just had the London inner city upbringing.
Yeah, I was going to say, quite a contrast. Huh? So, I mean, that leads right on to imagination. I'm going to take that as a bridge to imagination and just say at this point, so you work as an imagination activist. It's a very captivating term for me, at least. Of course, I want to get into what that work entails. But before I get there, I'd like to ask what maybe seems like a simple question. Because I've heard you talking about the shortcomings of thingifying imagination. And I just want to ask you, can you describe in your words, what is imagination?
Gosh, almost through asking what is imagination as a thing, you could end up, you know, going down that route. But the root of the word is around image, imagere, in the Latin term, you know, it evokes imaging and vision. And I think from that, you know, you could say if something is about visioning or seeing something that's not there, you could interpret that as seeing things that are not there, seeing the future. That's the thingifying. Oh, let's do imagination. Oh, great. That's like positive futures and, you know, imaging the future. The way I work with imagination is that it's about a different vision. So seeing differently and being able to use imagination to actually influence a different form of vision. And actually, William Blake used to talk about this, the kind of one-fold, two-fold, three-fold, four-fold vision. There's a brilliant quote where he talks about the kind of impoverished one-fold vision of Descartes and the kind of reductionist view of the world as if it's just what we see materially around us. And then you've got two-fold vision and three-fold vision where it's layering up meaning and richness and seeing or sensing what is not there until you get to this four-fold vision, which is like divine state of being in the world, but kind of seeing more than is materially there. So I think that's part of this work, is how do we use imagination to expand our perception of who we are and what is in the world. You know, you can look at a tree and you can see wood, or you can look at a tree and see a living, entangled, mysterious and enchanting being. Mm-hmm. The tree hasn't changed. You've changed. Your imagination is part of that change.
All right. But so when you are introducing yourself as an imagination activist, I can imagine that you are met with kind of quizzical looks and questions along the line of the one I'm about to ask you, which is, what exactly is an imagination activist and what does the work entail?
It was a term that like cohered two different bodies of thought I had, and that you can listen to the podcast episode that I recorded with someone called Dan Burgess on Spaceship Earth, The Imagination Activist, I think it's called. And that's where this term came into being. And it really came like a light bulb moment. Like, this is the term that describes this thing that I think we need more of, and that, you know, that puts this work into practice. What is the role for somebody who is working with imagination and expanding the imagination of those around them and themselves in order to open up new possibilities, new ways of seeing, shifting the way we relate to each other and ourselves, and making that into a practice. So it's not just like you're either born an imagination activist or you're not. There are practices and, you know, training and work that can be done to expand this capacity. What this looks like is using exercises, tools, practices, and also prioritizing creating space and time and creating a culture of permission to think differently, to think radically. And that deep, slow work that it takes to shift one's ontology, epistemology, even kind of worldview, it takes a long time. And anybody who's engaged in shifting the way they see the world, it's like meditation. It takes practice. It's like a muscle that requires working out and flexing and practice. It's not like it's a physical muscle. It's also about confidence. It's about unblocking the blocks to that free flow, you know, improv and creativity and spontaneity. It takes work to unblock some of that. It's not just about adding it on.
Absolutely. And the unblocking, right? You talk about training a muscle and you compare it there to learning to meditate and to the gradual process of seeing the world through different eyes. Mm. Can you give me an example of a beginner's exercise to somebody who is looking to build their imagination muscle?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, going back to the tree, that's a really simple one to do, is to actually start tuning into the way you see a tree. So this is an early exercise I used to do with people around building relationship to the natural world. So if you find yourself a tree and you start to use your imagination to imagine all the roots, imagine the mycelium connected with the roots, all the relationships between the tree and the soil microorganisms. You know, you can use your imagination to imagine the oxygen that is being emitted from the leaves of the tree and the carbon dioxide that's being absorbed. So this kind of flow of air and minerals, like seeing the interbeing and entangled nature of the tree. And then you can start to imagine all of the more than human species that actually relate to and depend on this tree. Maybe you can see like lichen on the branches and on the trunk, and you know that lichen is actually a symbiosis of fungi and algae. So there's even more organisms that are there on the tree that are in relationship with each other and with the tree itself. And then last of all, you can tune into, what is my relationship to this tree? Mm-hmm. What does this tree mean to me? What are the ways that I'm glad this tree exists? And what does it bring me? What kind of joy does it bring? Shelter? Does it bring a beautiful view? Does it remind me of someone or a memory? So it's this sort of practices to strengthen your sense of interbeing with nature. And a tree is a great place to start because they're usually quite easy to find.
What that sounds like to me, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting here, but it sounds like an invitation to imagine reality. I mean, because
yeah,
those things are all there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that was like something that became clear to me pretty early in this work, was that actually, you know, we think of imagination as something that takes us away from the world, but this, whatever this form of imagination that I'm in and developing and being influenced by and developing a practice around, is imagination that brings us more closely into relationship with the world. And I call the practices that I've developed moral imagination, which maybe is different to fantastical imagination or creative imagination, or, you know, so there's something to me that is a moral act to develop a deeper connection with the world as it is, rather than try and escape it.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question to you as well, because you set up an organization called Moral Imaginations.
That's right. Yeah.
So can you just give me a few words on where the moral comes into it?
Yeah, the term moral imagination actually is a term that has existed for centuries, and it was introduced to me by one of my mentors, Joanna Macy, who would talk about the power of the moral imagination in seeing with new eyes. And so Joanna's been really a huge influence on this work. I've got her in my mind because she's actually the person who's really encouraged me to fully develop this practice as a branch of the work that Reconnects, which is her body of work. And so moral imagination really is imagination on behalf of the welfare of the whole. You know, imagination is the source of nuclear weapons. It's the source of nation states and wars. But actually, what is the force of imagination that is on behalf of the well-being of all people and future generations? That's where moral imagination comes in. It's the use of imagination to build empathy, to create a world that better serves all and leads to, as you said, like a more in touch state with reality and our interdependence with the living world.
Yeah, count me in. I was reading your manifesto and there was this one bit that stood out for me. I'm convinced that to shift the future, we need to feel into it differently. If the ways of thinking we're familiar with are leading us to dead ends, perhaps the only way to circumvent them is to go via a different route. And I'm really interested in the word feel there. Yeah. Can you talk me through how do we encourage people to feel into things differently? I mean, it's a big one, isn't it?
Yes, and it's also the core of this work. That manifesto was written back in 2020, so it's now like 4 years old. I wrote it just maybe 3 months into the pandemic. I had been working on a project funded by Unbound Philanthropy around how to develop post-COVID narratives that could encourage a more pro-social and just response to the pandemic, because there was a lot of kind of shutting down of generosity and a focus on the self and like survival. So a lot of my thinking at that time was around, how can we shift attitudes towards people who are different to us? And on the progressive left, often the routes that are taken amongst strategic communicators and campaigners who are designing campaigns to try and shift perspective is to use data. There's evidence that shows that actually the rational mind is not actually where the action is in terms of our opinions and the way we feel about the world and ourselves and the way we imagine ourselves. You know, Jonathan Haidt has the metaphor of the rider and the elephant. You've got the kind of the human rider that thinks that it's in, you know, they're in control, but then you've got this elephant, which is where your feelings and emotions and kind of deep narratives that were maybe even like deep myths about what it means to be human and what the future looks like and what you have a right to. And, you know, this is that deeper level where actually the way we make decisions and the opinions we have and who we really are exists in those deeper narrative waters. And so to me, imagination and working at this level of the imagination engages people at that deeper level. It invites people to imagine differently. And when you do collective imagining, it actually invites people to also imagine with others and build a shared understanding. So the way to do that is rather than telling someone, here are all the facts and figures about what you should think, creating spaces where someone could participate with their imagination and then explore that imagination with others and kind of combine and contrast what's important to them and why and how that comes out of imagining different futures or imagining their lives differently. So it's engaging people at a deeper, more emotion-led level.
Yeah, wow. Okay. So I'm to go back to the talking about the natural world for a moment. So, I mean, as I understand it, at the heart of the work you do is the natural world, is a desire to see it treated in a different way.
Mm.
So, I mean, you talked about the tree, but can you explain how you can use the work in groups, in societies, or in communities to change the extractive mindset, perhaps, to just generate the connection also to ourselves, perhaps first and foremost, but then to one another, and to then build that out into communities, into society? I mean, I know you gave me the example of the tree, which I love, but I'm sure that there's more going on than that.
Mm-hmm. So I think the key is that, you know, having spaces where people can connect to what is truly important to them, to their sense of values, to their sense of civic virtue, and then giving voice to those visions of how things could be and what's truly important to them. And then there are these, you know, exercises where we engage in the role play of having a conversation with somebody from the future. On the surface, it sounds like that's like a frivolous, you know, kind of fun thing to do. But actually, when you have a conversation with somebody imagined, but, you know, as we know from cognitive science, when you really imagine something with enough detail and that is, you know, lifelike enough, your brain registers it, at least to some extent, as real. I've had people in my exercises and workshops who say there were moments where I kind of slipped into really feeling like I was looking at somebody from 7 generations in the future. And I found myself having kind of chills and goosebumps and feeling this sense of responsibility and to actually be letting down the future generations and needing to shift how I think about my life and work and kind of purpose. So we're talking about the future and climate and what it means to be human and who are we as a species and why do we live with inequality and you know, asking these really big questions that can be really tricky to have just as a normal discussion. You know, if you bring together a group of people and you say, okay, let's talk about equality or let's talk about what the future should look like, people will naturally tend towards going into a kind of rational, analytical conversation about like, this is how it should be. And then you get this drive into polarization and, you know, in conflict and disagreement and a limited space of what kinds of conversations are possible. I really think imagination is the gateway to thinking in a more holistic and connected and less reductionist way, and it invites more parts of the person into the conversation as well. It invites their memories of the past, their relationships with their family, with their partner, their hopes, their dreams, their fears. It's a very different quality of conversation that is possible.
And that's also then where the feeling aspect plays back in.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are plenty of crises in the world. There are plenty of systems that could do with a major overhaul. And talking to you here, these ideas sound very convincing. I'm wondering how you get them into enough people to have a kind of groundswell so that it trickles upwards to where it needs to be in a way.
Well, I think it's about engaging the people who are also in positions of power, as well as this like more bottom-up approach. And I think some of that is about showing, you know, the research and evidence and starting to shift. I hope that my work on complexity and imagination will also, you know, influence people who can change things like curriculums. And we're already have a lot of incoming interest and requests from schools. And the work that Moral Imaginations has been doing has been mainly with local councils and communities. So piloting and developing a curriculum and training program. Moral Imaginations is a small organization, but we're trying to influence people from different parts and sectors of society. And I'm thinking about other ways to get the ideas out at a bigger scale.
How's it gone down? I mean, so I know that you've done work with Camden Council. Maybe it would be interesting for people to hear about a project that you have been involved in and how you have shaped something, changed the way that things are done in place X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, so our big pilot project is with Camden Council, which is a 3,000-person organisation in the centre of London, with 300,000 residents in the borough, London Borough of Camden. Together with them, in partnership, we developed a programme to train people in this, you know, form of activism. I had been developing and experimenting with different practices and exercises for years before that. But this was the moment where we said, okay, what would it look like to actually bring together all of these exercises and practices and develop a training that could train a group of council officers in imagination activism to become imagination activists? And so we developed an 8-week training. So every week we engaged with 30 council officers from a really diverse demographic across the council, from green spaces and housing and child care services and working with families, working with finance. So it was, you know, a really broad group from across the council. We took people from all different levels and we brought them together into a cohort to train them as imagination activists who would then have the legitimacy to go out and spread these practices and train others in the organization. So this happened between September and November 2022. And what happened was, like, we unleashed an enormous amount of energy. Like, it, you know, the director of people and inclusion, Joe Brown, who was our project sponsor, said she'd never seen anything like it, like from any kind of council training program she'd ever been part of. Like, the amount of energy and excitement and motivation, and beyond the course, how much people went on to then organize sessions and workshops with the rest of the council. And, you know, we now have the group of 30 imagination activists are like an internal resource for the council. So they get invited to strategy sessions and away days and team meetings to come in and bring the tools and practices into those places and to influence their colleagues and to change the kinds of conversations that are possible, and then to take it out to residents. There's a community bus that goes out into the borough to work directly with residents. So they've been using the bus to go and run imagination sessions with residents. The head of libraries in Camden helped reimagine what the 9 libraries in the borough could be used for. So trying to imagine into the future and in including the residents in this imagining. So it's a really participatory tool. And, you know, there's a lot more. So they run regular monthly what if sessions with the entire council around different topics. So housing, or one of the questions from our curriculum was, what if future generations were represented in every decision in the council? And then just now we finished training the leadership of Camden. So the entire senior leadership group has also been trained in these methods and practices, and with the ability to voice, you know, bring the voice of future generations into meetings, bring the voice of nature into meetings, and do the work to connect with their ancestors and the ancestors of Camden. So it's been quite an extraordinary journey, which we're still on.
So they're breaking down barriers within their own minds and ways of thinking and doing and being.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty, that's a good explanation of it. Yeah. You know, they've integrated imagination into their leadership model of the organization. Wow. So one of the mindset shifts that we work with in our curriculum is to move from rational thinking only to intuitive and imaginative thinking as well as the rational. And so they've really enshrined that in their leadership model for the whole organization.
I was going to ask how the work that you do has gone down with people who've been exposed to, and you've answered some of it there in the context of Camden, but I mean, you must come into contact with an awful lot of other people. Mm. Yeah. Are there sort of standard responses to the work of imagination activists? Are there camps of thought around it?
It's interesting. I've got a couple of quotes from some of the participants who went through the program. Some of the things people say are quite evocative. So here's someone who said, "I felt able to speak up more about the things I feel are important, translating how I feel instinctively into something useful." And someone said, "You know, the tools we learn in the program feel freeing, creates the psychological safety to think differently and beyond what we ever thought was possible." So a lot of the response is like, almost like a sense of being, of building confidence in a capacity, in a way of being that isn't, it's not foreign, but it's underused. I think there are people that meet this program with skepticism. Often it's the people with a legal, finance, or operations background, and they're kind of like, why would we do this? Why would we spend time on this when, you know, we've got to be rational. We've got to sort the budgets, which, you know, it's yes and. It's not like this is more important than doing budgets or operations, but unleashing thinking and bringing a full capacity of feeling and thinking and your purpose into your work.
Those little quotes that you read out there, it sounds very much like people feel they've been given permission to explore what is already within them.
Yeah. Yep. I think permission is a big, big, big part of this. My personal theory of people is that we all have the inherent capacities to be imaginative, to see the world in a complex way, to perceive our interdependence with the world, with each other, with the natural world. I think that's how we're born. That's our natural state. And then it's through the conditioning of society, of school, of families, of all of the Western industrial way of seeing and thinking and acting starts to shut down what is an inherently natural capacity. So this isn't about adding something new. It's about reconnecting with and strengthening and shifting towards something that, you know, maybe quite a long time ago was an inherent capacity.
Yeah, I mean, as kids, we are so free to explore our own curiosity boundlessly. Okay, I have one last question for you. And that's, if you could ensure that everybody on the planet had one skill, what would you choose that skill to be?
It's a really interesting question. Some of the things that come up for me, the obvious one would be imagination, but I think that would be a cop out. And rather what comes up is patience. One of the things I think we are really in danger of is the rushing and the rush to just kind of gain, extract, you know, extract information, extract value, rushing. So that comes to mind. But there's also, yeah, connected to the rushing, it's that extractive, I think one of the most damaging things that is inherent in Western culture is the kind of me, selfish, extractive way of just interacting with and engaging with the world, with each other. It's like, what can I get from you? And then, you know, competition and actually wishing you harm so that I can benefit. So that kind of competitive, selfish way of seeing and engaging. And I wish everybody would have the skill to trust in their being enough, you know, in the kind of win-win possibility of being on Earth, that it's not a zero-sum game, that there, you know, that trust that there's enough for everybody, the kind of abundance mindset. I think that would be a skill that would serve us all well.
Okay. Thank you so very much for your thoughts and for joining me here. I feel like it's a conversation that could go on forever.
And it's a conversation that is constantly evolving and, you know, teaching me as it goes on and through conversations like this with people like you. So thank you for your amazing questions.
Yeah, we'll have to check back in then in a year's time and see how it's evolved.
Very happy to.
If you enjoyed exploring imagination with Phoebe as much as I did, you'll now be buzzing with ideas and itching to get outside and find a tree to begin looking at through newly opened eyes. And if you want to know more about Phoebe's work, there are links in the show notes. And I can also recommend her animated Impossible Train Story. I'll be back next month with a new episode of the Inner Green Deal podcast. But you don't need to wait that long if you want to hear other interesting conversations with people working on sustainability and the establishment of deeper connections to ourselves and the world around us, because the archives contain plenty. And as ever, feel free to subscribe or share. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining me again next time. Bye-bye.